Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann. Facial recognition at international airport gates is an increasingly common form of travel security. In a 2017 executive order, President Donald Trump expedited the Customs and Border Protection Agency's biometric exit plan. The program is intended to prevent travelers from overstaying their visas, but concerns about privacy and accuracy have been raised. Jeffrey Fowler is a tech columnist for The Washington Post. He covers the CBP biometrics program. He joins us by Skype. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi there.
I have never seen one of these face scans, or at least I don't think I have. What do they look like at the airports?
So I actually recently spent an entire day at New York's JFK Airport, both giving one a try and watching what happened when lots of passengers use them. Basically, it looks like a normal gate area that you might use to board a plane, but it's the area where normally someone on the staff of the airport checks your passport one last time before you board and then scans your ticket. But instead of having humans there to do that, there's these little electronic gates. They're usually about three wide that you step up. There's a little gate. You look up at a box slightly to your right with a camera in it. You smile ever so slightly for that camera. And if it recognizes you, you're on through. You didn't even have to scan your airport ticket or show your passport to anyone. If it doesn't recognize you, then you get pulled out and you have to go talk to an airline worker directly.
And they are comparing this picture to a passport picture.
Yeah, this is where it starts to get tricky. So how do they know if it's really you? This was sort of the number one concern that I heard from people waiting in the gate area. What they're doing is they're taking a photo of you in that moment, and they're comparing it to a centralized government database of the photos of people who live or in America or might be visiting America. And that's what started to get civil liberties types pretty concerned about this, because this is the biggest step America has taken yet towards normalizing the use of our faces as data that can be stored and tracked and then inevitably possibly stolen.
I suppose there's a little bit of a creepiness factor here into who is watching us, right?
For sure. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is how this issue gets framed. In your setup a little bit earlier, you said that this was a security feature of airports. And is it really? I mean, what's happening here at this last check when you get onto the plane has less to do with security and I think more to do with the efficiency of the airline. They want to save time. In fact, one airline told me that it saves 2 seconds per passenger to use this automated system instead of a human. That also means maybe they'll have to hire fewer humans to staff this area of the airport. But it also is about immigration enforcement, which is different than security. Everybody who's in the airport has already been checked on a list to make sure that, you know, they're allowed to fly. They're not on a do not fly list. Everybody has already gone through security. They've already been scanned. Their bags have been scanned. This is really about this last step before you board, where some people in the U.S. government want to see if we can find more people who might have overstayed their visas and sent maybe someone who looks a little bit like them instead. And there's just the data suggests that actually doesn't really happen that often. Only 1% of U.S. Visitors here on visas overstay their visa each year, and probably a much smaller number of them try this sneaky path to get somebody else to leave the country for them instead. So what are we really gaining out of this system in exchange for the creepiness of having the government keep a database of our faces?
Before we had facial recognition, and it's not in every airport, how is it usually done, that last check before, you know, passengers board?
Yeah, well, historically, America has not required that U.S. citizens have to be checked in this way before they leave the country. It's not like in Europe where they, you know, have these sort of instituted, you know, larger passport checks. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're allowed to just kind of leave. But after 9/11, the Congress said that we should be checking visitors before they leave. And normally that's done by a human who is on top of, again, the checks that you've already gone through when you checked in and when you've gone through security. This is that one final check to make sure that that you are the person who has that ticket. And they're just, you know, looking at the photo on the page and making a judgment if that's you.
What's the relationship between the Customs and Border Protection Agency and the airlines?
Well, it's a really interesting one because essentially the way that these systems have been built up over the last 2 years, the airlines are building these systems for customs. And this is kind of an interesting element in this. Why is corporate America building what some people might consider sort of a facial recognition surveillance system
that the government
for the
would
U.S.
use.
Government? Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And they are partners in it. So that centralized database that we talked about that has all of the source photos, the ones from passports and whatnot, that is run by customs. So the airports have to like tap into this government database to check and then decide whether to let the people through.
You wrote in your article that anybody, any passenger can opt out. Can any passenger opt out? And if so, how do they do it?
Yeah, well, to opt out, first of all, you have to know that it's going on. And that's part of what's tricky here. That, today at that gate I watched in New York for JetBlue, they made several announcements that said that the system was in place. They had a couple signs up. But still, you know, a lot of people are nervous, not paying attention, who knows, and they just think this is what you have to do. So first, you have to look for the signs that this thing is there. There might literally be signs that might make announcements. Or any time that you're in a situation where somebody's asking you to remove your hat or remove your sunglasses or to look in a special place, that's probably because they're using facial recognition technology. Now, on top of that, but you should go in knowing your rights. So at this time, like if you go to my column on the Post website, I actually even give you a link. You could show to anybody who doesn't believe you. Customs says that it does not require U.S. citizens or aliens to have their pictures taken when entering or exiting the country. You do have the right to opt out, but you have to tell them that. Same goes for TSA at security checkpoints where they're starting to experiment with this technology as well. You do have the right to say, no, I don't want to be a part of this.
I think we have a caller who has been through this, at least in some experience. Heather from Delaware, what's your comment or question, please?
Hi. We traveled from the U.S. to Canada and back this summer, and on a way back from Canada, I had to go through this area, and because of his article, thank goodness, I knew I didn't have to comply with it. So, and we'd just gone through the second security scan, too. We had to take everything off, and it was crazy, and no one, they were terrible about giving directions. So we get through this, and I say, I don't want to do this. And she's like, what? You know, you don't want to do this? Why not? And all this stuff. I think she was trying to talk me into it. So then she says, okay, we'll go up to this other area and go through that way. So I go up there, and then he says, well, where's your card? You have to fill out this card. So I go all the way back, ask the second lady, oh, no, no, you have to take your picture. Well, no, I don't have to take a picture. Where's the card? Oh, okay, well, that's over there. So I go over there, and they have cards in every language. They do not have any English cards to fill out except for the very top one that's an example of what's in the thing below it, right, which is nothing's there. So my son was able to use a pen and get it out. Oh, and by the way, when the guy tells me that you need this card to fill out, why he just didn't give me one is beyond me. So anyway, I finally get the card filled out. I go back through again. Another guy was like kind of trying to talk me to do the picture thing again. But we finally went through, and I just, it was ridiculous that, I don't know why they treat people like that. It really, really upset me. And by this point, I had two little kids with me. It was just so frustrating.
And you had the opportunity to opt out, but they didn't make
it
easy, apparently.
I did opt out, but I had – no, it was not easy at all. It was not easy at all. I basically had to stand my ground. And I don't know what I would have done if I wasn't able to pull that card out of the top slot because there were no English cards there.
That's really weird, ridiculous, too. Jeffrey, your comment on that, because I think you might have experienced this something similar. And obviously, Heather read your article.
Yeah, I think what the caller is talking about is that there are multiple points at which the government might want to take a photo of your face. She's talking about re-entering the country. And there have been programs that do that for much longer. But again, the law says that that you don't have to participate in that. What's newer and what I was talking about previously is when you exit the country, right? Because that was a place we didn't normally have to do it. And that's where they're trying to use these automated systems to with the idea that they'll speed things up or catch people who who, you know, we really have overstayed a visa. But the other thing that I think the caller's point makes really nicely is that these systems are essentially a convenience trap, right? So we're being told, oh, this is going to speed up things at the airport, and you'll go faster here. You'll go faster eventually at bag drop. You'll go faster at that TSA security line. You'll board the plane faster. And if you don't participate in it, essentially what's going to happen is you're going to get pushed to a slower and slower and slower line. And so what does it really mean to opt out? We really have the power to opt out of these things if we have an objection.
Heather,
ultimately,
My question to Heather is, you had children with you, you said. Was there any move that they had to have their picture taken? Or you, since you didn't go through the process, you don't know.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
You had children with you. Were they going to have their faces scanned as well?
They probably would have, yeah, but I was not about to let them do that. And, you know, when I told them they didn't have these cards there, they didn't really care. they really didn't.
Heather, thank you. I appreciate that. First-hand knowledge is good to share. Jeffrey, obviously the opting out isn't necessarily made easy. And is that part of what you found when you did your article as well? And if so, what's being done about that to bring more information to passengers?
Yeah. So when I sat and watched travelers leaving the U.S. from JFK, you know, there were officials from JetBlue there with me watching me watch. So they made sure that everything went pretty smoothly that day. So people did have the option to say no, and they could just go over to the human and to have their passport checked and go through that way. When I asked Delta, like, how often people opt out of what they call their biometric terminal in Atlanta, they said about 2% of people opt out. I think the bigger concern for me actually is how often the technology failed. So even if you said, okay, fine, or you just didn't know what was going on, in the case that I watched, and about 15% of the people, that the system was not able to recognize them. And those people all also had to go to that slower line and be checked by the human. And there's lots of concerns that have been raised about the accuracy of this kind of technology. You know, does it recognize women's faces as well, or the faces of people of color? And again, are we going to set up a system where the airport works better for some people because of their ethnicity or gender? That doesn't seem like an America we want to build either.
There was a cyber attack at the Columbus and Customs and Border Protection Agency. Can you explain the attack and then what meant for privacy concerns because of what happened?
Yeah. So the day that I published my column about this in the Washington Post, I published it in the morning, and then I'm having lunch, and I get a call from the customs folks who I had been speaking with, you know, previously in preparing my column, and they said, "Oh, you know how you asked us if this data had ever been stolen from that customs database?" And they said, "Well, looks like it has been."
Facial ID. Photos,
that's correct.
Yes.
So what had been stolen? We didn't really learn a lot about it until some weeks after, as sort of some of the details started emerging and the data itself showed up on the dark web. And one of my colleagues at the Post was able to download it. It looked like what happened was there were people crossing what looked like the Canadian border into the U.S. and customs had a system in place that was taking photographs, not just of their faces, but also of the license plates on their cars, because these are people passing through in cars. And a contractor of customs had kept that data on their server, even though customs promised that they deleted it all after 12 hours. This contractor kept the data, and someone hacked in and got to it. So in this case, we kind of got out lucky, because it doesn't appear that those faces and license plate numbers were associated with people's names or other kind of identifiable information. If they had, that would have been the key, right? That would have said, this is the facial map of this person. And of course, we can't really change our faces very easily. So we have to be very careful about who's able to identify them.
Interesting stuff. Jeffrey Fowler, tech columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you for joining me this morning.
You bet.
We're going to take a quick break, and listeners, you can join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Gail Hogan, sitting in for Anne. If you have flown from a major airport out of the country, perhaps you didn't scan your ticket before getting on the plane. Maybe you scanned your face. Well, facial recognition might become more common in airports across the country. We're talking about facial recognition scans at the airport and the future of biometrics and the government. Joining me now by Skype, Taja Chapelet-Lanier. Taja, thank you for being with us. She's a technology reporter at FedScoop.
Thank you.
And Daniel Castro, the Vice President of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Daniel, welcome to you as well.
Happy to join you.
Daniel, you've encouraged the use of biometrics and less restrictions at airports. Can you tell us why?
Sure. Well, for one, my think tank did a survey earlier, or I guess late last year, it was December, where we asked consumers about their thoughts around facial recognition. And generally, we found that few were supportive of restrictions if it meant that they couldn't go through airports faster. So they were in favor of seeing this speed up their processing through security lines. They were even in favor of doing this just in the general public if restrictions would limit how it could be used for public safety.
And what were some of those restrictions that they wanted to see?
Well, so we didn't get into the restrictions in the survey, but what we've seen since then, of course, is everything from bans to calls for moratoriums on the use of the technology. If you look at the last 5 years in terms of how the technology has developed, we've seen that it now reaches levels of accuracy that exceeds what humans can do when they're manually verifying someone's ID or trying to identify somebody in a crowd.
So you think that this technology is improving, and because of its improving, it should be used more?
Right. I mean, I think everyone is right to be concerned about appropriate uses and some of the concerns, for example, around bias of the technology. But what you have to do is you have to compare it against what's being done today and ask, is it an improvement? And so we know today, for example, that there are also biases in how humans recognize people. And so the real question is the technology better than what humans do? And on that metric, it's a clear performance improvement.
Taja, you wrote about the political response to the biometric program. How are politicians responding?
That's a good question. I think that there's been some concern on Capitol Hill, some kind of skepticism among members of Congress about facial recognition. There have been a number of hearings calling civil rights advocates to talk about this issue, and then members of the security community as well. And I think DHS, Department of Homeland Security, from their perspective, is sort of saying, like, well, we're following an old legislative mandate here, and yes, that there are concerns about this technology. We want to work with you on what those concerns are, but we're following the law as it's been set out thus far.
Apparently, opting out is confusing, and some travelers don't know they have that option. In your piece, lawmakers discussed advanced notice. What do lawmakers mean by that? Trying to make this more obvious to travelers or give them more notice?
Yeah, I think that's a really big issue here, I would say. It's unclear what lawmakers mean by that. They have been pretty vague so far, but I think the issue that they're bringing up is that currently, when you walk into an airport and you're faced with this biometric exit process, you might get an alert over the loudspeaker from the airline staff members who are helping you board the plane, and there are also Customs and Border Protection notices, like a big sheet of paper that kind of spells out what is happening and what your rights in regard to that are. But lawmakers are arguing basically that when you're in the airport about to board the plane is not the best time for consumers to make the best decision for them. And so whatever that is, whether they're okay with this trade-off, privacy versus security, or whether they're not okay with that trade-off, I think lawmakers are beginning to make the point that some advance notice would be nice for people.
We are going to take a caller now. This is Troy from Columbus. Troy, your comment or question, please.
Yes, I just recently traveled to Europe through Italy and Germany. And, you know, while we may have the right here in this country to refuse to be scanned, have our facial recognition, you know, stored on a computer someplace. I'm not so sure if you have that other option in some other countries, because they're already starting to use it. And when I came through Germany, you basically walked up to a kiosk, you inserted your passport, you looked at a camera, it took a picture, and your information is stored. So I'm not sure if we have that right anywhere we travel in the world.
Troy, thank you for that observation. And Daniel, do you know what is going on in other countries and if they are using it like the United States differently?
Well, what I'd point out is that while Americans have the right to opt out in the U.S., foreign nationals traveling to the U.S. don't have that right. So in a sense, I think it's probably pretty parallel in other countries. Certainly in some European countries, people are going to have more privacy rights as Europeans, but others maybe traveling through won't have the same rights. So it's really going to vary. And then, of course, you know, China is kind of an outlier in that it seems to be collecting an extremely large amount of biometric data, not only in airports, but in other public places, and widely using that data.
If the goal of the scan is to catch visa holders, and this is for Daniel, visa holders who are trying to overstay, why does the CBP program scan everyone going through the gate, not just non-citizens? Is it just easier, more time?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I think there's a few places where it's being used, right? So one's for boarding planes and one's through the entry-exit part. You know, for the entry-exit, I mean, you do have, you know, some different lines for Americans versus non-Americans, but I think they also want to, they generally try and standardize the process. For many people, I think they're going to find that using the facial recognition option is faster, and it's not really going to be a trade-off between privacy and security. It's going to be a trade-off between convenience and privacy. And so I think that's why they want to do it. They're just a kind of typical government agency trying to do more with less.
Taja, at this point, in some respects, it doesn't seem that the public minds this. In public reports, it shows most airline passengers don't blink an eye, so to speak, when they had to go through facial recognition. Some might even not even know possible issues with it. But as more people become familiar with it, and maybe some have a problem, do you think that's when lawmakers might start to take interest?
I would say my perception right now is that the level of interest in this, the level of skepticism about this in Congress is far above what the level of interest and skepticism is among the general public, which I think is really interesting. I went to something called the Biometric Tech Rally that the Department of Homeland Security has held twice now to test different biometric screening systems, and they pay volunteers to come and go through in lines, like mock the airport experience to see how fast and accurate these systems are. And every volunteer who I spoke with there, and granted that's a certain group of people who have chosen to be in this place, but everyone was raving about how easy it was and how they couldn't wait to have this experience during their travel experiences as well. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out with regard to the interest in among politicians and members of the media, frankly, as well, and the general public, and whether those come into line in some way or not. I don't know.
Daniel, there's a lot of places where our photographs pop up on Facebook, other social media sites. That's just the beginning. So it appears people don't really care if their photos are out there, or they don't realize how others could use this information. Do you think that's true? And does that have any then correspondence with facial recognition?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. I think there are at least a portion of Americans that care a lot about the government collecting data about them. So they're okay with Facebook having the data, and they're okay with their friends uploading photos that include them to Facebook. Sometimes they don't like it, but they're generally not, you know, demanding new laws to prevent that. But they are, you know, very skeptical of the idea of large, you know, government or big government intruding in their personal lives. And so I think there are some people, and we saw this in some of the hearings this summer, you know, that are going to be very resistant to this idea of, you know, the FBI, for example, creating larger databases or building databases from driver's license or other identity documents. But the second component of the photos is that increasingly photos are going to be tied to geolocation information. So you see this photo was taken of this person in this particular place. And the concern there is that this will evolve into a pervasive real-time surveillance of where individuals are going in the world. So you're not so concerned about the picture of your face. You're really concerned that your location has been tracked as you move throughout the public space. And that's where I think, you know, it's important that we establish clear, a clear constitutional right and, you know, uphold our, rights against unreasonable search. And, you know, there has been the Supreme Court case that has generally said you need a warrant to track somebody's location. But I think there's still some doubt in this space. And that's where I think Congress could provide reassurance that, you know, you cannot track someone's location, even through historical data that might be coming from the private sector, without a warrant.
So is there too little regulation, do you think, when it comes to biometrics right now?
Well, I wouldn't say too little in the sense that we're not seeing widespread abuse of that yet, but I think that is one of the maybe legitimate concerns of how this technology could be abused sometime in the future. And so now is the time to get ahead of that concern, kind of regardless of how the Supreme Court might rule on it, and just be clear that it's the intent of Congress that law enforcement cannot track somebody in real time, whether it's through a historical system or through real-time information, using biometrics unless they have a warrant.
Taja, airports at this point are the biggest piece of development when it comes to facial recognition. Where can we see facial recognition going in the coming years?
I think with regard to government agencies who are using facial recognition, it's really in law enforcement and security. So there are a number of law enforcement agencies that are using facial recognition. The Secret Service has a pilot ongoing. We're about to wrap up. And those are the main areas thus far where we've seen facial recognition. And I think the areas where, you know, they're the most legitimate security and safety concerns that balance out this or justify the use of this new technology in the minds of a lot of people, certainly not everyone, but in the minds of a lot of people, it makes it a worthwhile trade-off.
What are the security risks? And Daniel, I'll direct this to you. If our face becomes another piece of data, our emails, photos online, social security number, what are the security risks if people get a hold of our facial recognition data?
Well, the good thing about a lot of biometrics is they're trying to, they recognize this idea that, well, somebody can have a picture of your face. That doesn't mean they should be able to pass a facial recognition authentication challenge. And so there's a lot of work that's gone into making sure that when it's a camera is looking at a face, that it's an actual, if you're trying to authenticate somebody's identity, for example, that this is not just matching two photos, but if it's a live image of somebody, that it's a real person. And so I think here's where there's a really big opportunity to actually improve security. I mean, even if we're just talking about government operations, you know, the IRS loses over, a few billion dollars each year for fraudulent tax returns, where people are trying to claim someone's tax refund based on just their social security and their phone number or address. If you were tying this to other types of biometrics or even other forms of secure ID, that is a substantial amount of fraud that we could reduce. I think we should be looking for those types of opportunities. Same with credit card fraud, banking fraud. Right now, a lot of times we're just using, numbers or, weak passwords to verify our identity, verify our ownership of these financial information. And that's a recipe for fraud and hacking.
We're talking about facial recognition, and the number you can call if you want to join the conversation is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Daniel, as we go further in this discussion, do you see more airports then? This is going to be the next step, that we have some major airports right now that have facial recognition, but the next step in this is more airports worldwide.
Absolutely. I think it's, right now when people are traveling, they already have to show their face. They have to show their passports usually or some other identity document. So it's a natural evolution. But we are going to see this, I think, in other commercial areas. I mean, certainly we see a lot of retailers starting to deploy facial recognition. For example, in the past, they would have a little wall in the back where they'd have pictures of known shoplifters. Now they're trying to feed that into facial recognition systems so they can automatically find them. You're also seeing this in some kind of different hospitality industries where you can recognize VIPs or provide people personalized service. So, for example, when you come into your hotel, you don't have to go through a long check-in progress. You can just maybe go up to a kiosk and you'll get your key automatically. So wow. Different types of applications like that.
Tasha, where do you see this going, facial recognition in other areas besides airports?
Yeah, I mean, we see, right, we unlock our cell phones, some people with their face now. I think it's incredibly convenient. And like Daniel pointed out, also our current method of securing some really important pieces of information, like our financial information, is known to be weak, especially after so many big data breaches. So much information about us is out there in a lot of cases. And how do we come up with a better way to secure things that are important to us? And, you know, I think there's definitely an argument to be made that biometrics, whether it's facial recognition or other biometrics, are really important part of where that might go.
When you talk about other biometrics, what would those be?
Iris scanning, fingerprints are other biometrics. At this biometric technology rally that DHS did, there were a number of companies that were also testing those for airport purposes, or some combination where you had a facial recognition system combined with iris scanning or fingerprints as well.
We are talking about facial recognition, especially at airports. We are going to say goodbye to our two guests. Tasha Chapelet-Lanier is a technology reporter at FedScoop. Thank you for joining us, Tasha.
Thank you so much.
And Daniel Castro is the Vice President of Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Daniel, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me on.
We're going to take a quick break. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Gail Hogan, in for Ann Fisher. The DHS is not the only U.S. law enforcement agency that uses facial recognition software, and concerns have been raised wherever it is implemented. Here in Ohio, a program called the Ohio Law Enforcement Gateway, OLEG, allows police to use facial recognition software to identify suspects and victims against a database of driver's licenses and other state documents. Here to talk about that is Dennis Hirsch. He's a Moritz College of Law professor, also a professor of law at Capital University, and director of the Program on Data and Governance at Moritz. From 2013 to 16, he served as an advisor to the Ohio Attorney General's OLEG Steering Committee, Ohio Law Enforcement Gateway Committee. Dennis, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit about what the steering committee is. We're going to call it OLEG for short.
Sure. So Ohio piloted facial recognition for law enforcement back in 2008, but it wasn't publicly known until 2013 when a Cincinnati Inquirer article brought that to light. And that proved very controversial at that point because they were using facial recognition and comparing it, as you said, against driver's license database, law-abiding citizens, their faces were being checked, et cetera. And so there was a bit of controversy. And then Attorney General DeWine, wisely, I think, decided to create an OLEG steering committee, mainly of law enforcement people, to review all of OLEG, what it was doing, what the policies were, and whether they needed to change.
And what were the parameters of it?
Exactly, yeah. What were the parameters of the committee?
Of the actual what was out there and what was being used.
So at the time, the parameters were, you know, very loose. So there were over 30,000 individuals who had access to this facial recognition database, by far, you know, far larger number than in any other state. And the limitations on what they could do were very loose. It was just they could use it so long as it was for a law enforcement purpose. That's very broad and leaves a lot of discretion. So so the steering committee looked at that and decided that they wanted to have an advisory group that included law enforcement people, but also non-law enforcement people, academics like me. My colleague Terry Enns from Moritz was there representing the ACLU. There was somebody from the public defenders. Greg Leschutka, former mayor, was in the group representing the Buckeye Institute. And there were a bunch of police chiefs and state highway patrol commanders and the like. So it was a very diverse and interesting group to work with. And so we also reviewed the policies, reviewed what Oleg was doing, especially with facial recognition, and made some recommendations. And our main recommendation was adopted into Bureau of Criminal Investigation's policy and is a policy today that limits the use of facial recognition in the state of Ohio.
Can you describe those limits?
Yeah, sure. So what the policy basically says is that the state or law enforcement can only use facial recognition for specific purposes. That is, they have to reasonably believe that that the use of the facial recognition will lead to evidence or investigative leads in a specific matter, or will prevent imminent harm or danger, or will enable them to identify somebody who cannot identify themselves. So those specific things, if it's not that, they can't use it. And so what that means is they can't do what we would call dragnet surveillance, where you're just surveilling everybody, mm-hmm. right, and trying to see who's there and who might have committed a crime or who has an outstanding warrant. And they can't do continuous surveillance of crowds, for example, people at political rallies. And in fact, the policy goes on to specifically say that it cannot be used for mass surveillance of First Amendment protected activity, such as political rallies and the like. And so the Bureau of Criminal Investigations committed to that. And I have to say that the people in the room, including the law enforcement community that and representatives who were there, all agreed that, you know, they didn't want to use facial recognition. They didn't intend to use facial recognition to limit First Amendment freedoms of speech and assembly and the like. They wanted to use it to further legitimate law enforcement purposes. And so that's what the policy says. And this was at the time and may still be today a relatively unique policy. Georgetown University Law School, which has done the leading reports on facial recognition among law enforcement in the United States, did an excellent report called The Perpetual Lineup that I recommend to any of your listeners who are interested in this. And they surveyed all 50 states to look at policies governing facial recognition. And they found that Ohio had the only policy of the 52 state agencies that they talked with that directly limited use and protected First Amendment activities in this way.
To keep it more regulated, obviously, for the protection of privacy and everything else for other folks. Is that correct?
Yes, right.
Law enforcement has said that this is a very good tool for them. Do you see how that could also not be, I want to say not a good tool, but could lead to some false arrests, just different things that might occur because of this?
Of course. So it's important that law enforcement be able to catch criminals and keep us all safe. And to some extent, facial recognition can assist with that. And so I think, you know, that's part of the picture. But it can also cause harms that
if abused.
If abused or if used incorrectly. That's right. So when I try to think about why it's important to have limits on facial recognition, I think, why is anonymity in public important? because essentially if you don't have limits on facial recognition, if our faces are being photographed and we are being identified, you know, as we go about our daily lives, as is technologically very feasible, then we will lose anonymity in public. And so why do we need anonymity in public? Well, we need it for political speech, right? So that we can speak freely about the government. Think about the Federalist Papers. Hamilton and Madison used a pseudonym. They didn't use their real names, right? There's a long tradition going back to our founding of anonymity with respect to political speech. We need it for freedom of assembly and freedom of association. There was documented incidents where the Baltimore police took photographs and conducted facial recognition surveillance of people attending a rally after the death of protesting the death of Freddie Gray by the Baltimore City Police. So that's an instance where facial recognition can be used in ways that inhibit, you know, protests. But this is not a partisan issue, right? You could be going to a pro-choice rally. You could be going to a pro-life rally. Your identity, oftentimes people want to keep private. Similarly, just your ability to take sensitive actions or make sensitive decisions, go get treatment for HIV, get an abortion, go to psychotherapy, you know, anything that you might feel private about, if we are being observed and if we are being identified, again, as is technically feasible, you lose that anonymity and you will be chilled from taking those types of actions. And we would, you know, end up living in kind of a gray society where everybody tries to conform, right? We'd have much less individuality, much less ability of people to kind of lead their real authentic lives and make some of those sensitive choices. So for all of those reasons, anonymity in public is important, and that means that limitations on facial recognition technology are important. It should be used for the productive purposes, and those productive purposes exist, but that should always be balanced against these other interests. And the real question is, how do you find the right balance?
Speaking of balance, where do you determine that Fourth Amendment draws the line on facial recognition then?
So this is a very interesting question. The Fourth Amendment only applies where there's a search or a seizure. And so in order for the Fourth Amendment to apply, there's got to be a search or a seizure. If you're walking down the street and your face is photographed, you're not being seized, right?
Right.
Now that then raises the question, is it a search? And the way the Supreme Court has interpreted this, it's a search if it offends your reasonable expectation of privacy. So the question for the Fourth Amendment becomes, does facial recognition offend your reasonable expectation of privacy? And courts have held, the Supreme Court has held, that the things you do in public are not private. And so being observed or photographed in public, it does not offend. You don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the things you do in public. The police don't have to get a warrant in order to tail you in your car. However, in a recent line of cases, United States versus Jones and the Carpenter case, the Supreme Court has held that continual surveillance over an extended period. In Jones, it was tracking somebody, the movements of somebody's car continuously for 30 days. That does offend our reasonable expectations of privacy. And so if you had the type of facial recognition that was tracking people continually, if we had cameras at the corner of, you know, up and down High Street, and we were seeing kind of who was going in there and who was not, and tracking people's locations, that might well offend the Fourth Amendment. So these issues have not fully been tested. There's a bunch of gray area in the law here, but we can start to see that some uses of facial recognition would in all likelihood be constitutional. Others would not. I have to say that the Constitution is only a floor. Of course, state legislatures, city councils, and others, the BCI in this case, Bureau of Criminal Investigation, that created this policy, are free to exceed that floor and provide more protection for individuals. And we're starting to see that happen. Just over the last month or so, there were three hearings in the House of Representatives, you know, that focused very directly on facial recognition, and where representatives from both sides of the aisle came out strongly against this, including Jim Jordan from Ohio, who said it's time for a timeout on facial recognition.
How do we compare this then to video cameras that are everywhere in the public? Isn't that kind of the same thing?
Sure. It depends on what's being done with those images.
So the images can be taken. It's what's done with them that can lead to problems.
Images being taken could present other issues, like if you had a video camera in a bathroom, for example. I mean, there are separate issues there, but what we're talking about now is videotaping or photographing people's faces and then using facial recognition technology to identify that individual.
When a police force, sheriffs, when they overstep those bounds that have been put in place by your OLEG committee, what happens?
So there is actually an instance of a police officer, former police officer from Put-In Bay, who used OLEG for 14 non-law enforcement searches. We don't know what they are. That wasn't released, but it was something non-law enforcement. And he was convicted of a felony and sent to prison for 150 days. Now, that conviction was later overturned on procedural grounds, but misuse of OLEG by a state employee is a felony, and you have to get specific permission to use OLEG. And mm-hmm. I should mention that while there were 30,000 people
who could use it
right at the beginning, that number has now been brought down to about 4,000. I still think that's too high.
That's a big change,
considerably
though.
Higher than many other states, and the audit requirements and the audit processes by the state with respect to its use of facial recognition, I think also, you know, bear further examination. And it's not clear that there's enough auditing to make sure that people are only using this in the proper way. But indeed, if they are caught not to be, the penalties are stiff.
Do you see increased oversight then of this as we go forward?
I think that would be an important positive development. Increased oversight by the legislature, increased transparency to the public. So I think that's very healthy, and increased transparency basically, and increased auditing. I mean, it's one thing to have rules, but are you checking? Are you being accountable to make sure that those rules are actually being followed? There was a recent instance where a public interest group asked the state of Massachusetts if they could tell how many times their facial recognition software had been used, and they were not even able to give that number. That's a real suggests a concern about is the use of this very, you know, powerful technology being properly supervised. And I think so long as it is properly supervised within, you know, reasonable constraints.
And the parameters that you put into place.
The parameters you put into place to protect our basic constitutional values, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, that we all want to enjoy as citizens. I think we can use this successfully, but it's going to take that level of governance, essentially. And it's going to take the legislature getting involved. It's going to take the state agencies and law enforcement being proactive about this and put the resources into it. And I think that will pay off for them, too, because the public needs to accept this. And this is a hard one, you know, for the American public to swallow with our concerns about Big Brother. So I think it's in law enforcement's interest to be proactive about this, show they can do it in a trustworthy way, audit what they're doing, and then I think maybe we have, a good balance there.
Dennis, thank you. Dennis Hirsch is a Moritz College of Law professor and director of their program on data and governance, also a professor of law at Capital University. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for today. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.